Hello and welcome to Pardes from Jerusalem, the podcast series from the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies in Jerusalem. I'm Larry Kluger, a Pardes alum. This week, Kitize. With the podcast up and running full strength on iTunes and everywhere else, now would be a great time to mention the podcast to your friends and neighbors. It's the month of Elul, which is designed to be a month of spiritual introspection as we move towards Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. So now is a great time to talk about the podcast and how you enjoy listening to it. And we're always interested in your comments. Please send them to info@pardes.org.il. This week, Rabbi Meir Schweiger discusses Kitize. Rabbi Meir Schweiger is a senior member of the Pardes faculty and also serves as the Pardes Mashkiach Ruchani, the spiritual guide for Pardes. And now, Rabbi Meir Schweiger.
Thank you, Larry. This week's parsha is Parshat Kitize. Today, I would like to revisit a topic which we have actually discussed in a previous podcast, namely the standards expected of a Jewish military camp. Let us look at chapter 23, verse 10. When your camp goes out against your enemies, guard yourself from any evil matter. The expression in Hebrew is davar ra. The rabbis understand davar not as matter, but rather as word, speech. And on that basis, the rabbis say that the first expectation is that when we are in a military camp, we are very careful about what we say. The rabbis talk about not saying lashon hara, evil speech, not maligning anyone, not gossiping. But one could take that to another direction. Not saying anything which is vulgar, which is coarse, which is unseemly. We know that speech is what God used to create the world. Speech is what reflects our human dignity, our being in the divine image, our majesty. The abuse of speech strips us of our human dignity. And so the Torah tells us the first thing, be careful how you speak. Secondly, it goes on to say in verse 11, if there is among you somebody who is not pure because of mikre laila, something which happened at night, he needs to go outside of the camp. He can't remain in the camp. What is mikre laila? Mikre laila is a seminal emission. The rabbis refer to the situation of a man who has a seminal emission as a bal keri. And the example and the terminology which is used in the Torah may very well be referring to a situation where there was not a conscious seminal emission, but rather something that was very much unconscious. It happened at night, what we call a nocturnal emission. And we're told, send this person out of the camp. He has no place in the camp. He is impure. And the rabbis have a whole discussion that says that when a man has a nocturnal emission, it's a reflection of what he is preoccupied with. What you think about in the day then comes out at night. And hence, if we see this on a larger level, it would be saying there is no room in the camp for someone who is preoccupied with sexual thoughts. One might say sexual promiscuity. Go outside the camp. And then we have the third thing in the next verse, where we're told that one needs to relieve themselves outside the camp. And not only relieve themselves, but to actually carry with them some type of implement, so that after they finish relieving themselves, they can dig a hole and cover it up. Relieving oneself is a natural human function. It is very interesting that in Masechet Brachot, there are a number of pages which are devoted to discussing what we might call proper bathroom etiquette. And inevitably, when people study it, it arouses chuckling. And at a certain point, it even seems to be silly. Why are the rabbis speaking so much about how you go to the bathroom? And yet, nevertheless, the rabbis see that how we go to the bathroom, how we relieve ourselves, is also very much a reflection of our human dignity. Animals relieve themselves anywhere and do not think twice about where to do so. But people, perhaps are trained or perhaps innately, recognize that there are places where you go and places where you don't go, and that the ability to distinguish where it is proper and where it is improper is once again a reflection of our human dignity and human majesty. So that the expectations of our military camp are that we uphold standards of speech. We uphold standards of thought. We uphold standards of how and when and where we exercise our basic physical needs. And after presenting us with these standards, the Torah actually gives us an explanation of why this is so important. And it says in verse 15, chapter 23, because the Lord your God is walking in your midst to save you from your enemies, to give them over into your hands, and therefore your camp shall be holy. And God should not see any nakedness, any matter of nakedness in you, and go back from being with you. It is very interesting that the idea of God walking in your midst is an expression that appears also in the Garden of Eden. It is also very interesting that it is in the context of where Adam and Eve have eaten from the tree of knowledge, in the aftermath of eating, and when all of a sudden they discover they're naked, when they're trying to hide their nakedness from God. In a previous podcast, I also tried to show various parallels between the Garden of Eden and between the Beit HaMikdash, the temple. So that if I put this all together, what the Torah is saying is, your military camp is a place where God's presence is walking. Your military camp is like a temple. And in the same way, the temple demands the highest standards of a person. It demands that they have the consciousness of their being before God. So too does the military camp demand that. And in the same way that the temple allows for an I-Thou encounter, which is meant to prolong our lives, to bring about expiation for our sins, so too is God's presence in the camp to enable us to overcome our enemies and go on with our lives. In last week's parsha, we also have a section in chapter 20, which begins with when you will go to war. And in that section, chapter 20, verse 19, we are given another directive. When we lay siege to a city for a long period of time, we need to be very, very careful to not destroy the trees that are outside the city. This is what is known as bal tashchit, wanton destruction. It is very, very striking that the Torah tells us that, because what immediately precedes that section is that we're told if the seven Canaanite nations do not respond to our call for peace, then we are to utterly destroy them. A verse which is very, very difficult for us to comprehend with our modern sensibilities and sensitivities. How could it be possible that the Torah asks us to engage in a war of total destruction? Let me put that on the side for a moment. But let me say that the Torah was also aware of the problematics of that statement. And that's why the Torah, before it says that, says, when you go out to battle, call out in peace first. And after that, the Torah says, when you lay siege to take a city, don't engage in wanton destruction. The Torah recognizes the brutality of warfare. The Torah may also recognize that in some cases, there is no choice. And yet, there need to be safeguards that are built in that help us to still maintain our humanity, our sensitivity, to not allow engaging in warfare to create within us this unbridled, one might even say lust, for destruction. Why is it that when ever the Torah speaks of going out to war, it actually says when you go out. Why not when you come in? Seems like a very, very trivial point, but it may be very important. Engaging in warfare takes us out of our daily routine. It breaks down all of the structures which we put in place to maintain our civility, our humanity. It is very interesting that in Parshat Ki Tetzeh, there are 74 mitzvot. The largest number of mitzvot, of commandments that appear in any parsha of the Torah. The bulk of the verses in Parshat Ki Tetzeh speak about day-to-day life situations. Why juxtapose going to war with these very mundane day-to-day laws? And it would seem to be that there is a very profound message, and that is for us to maintain standards of behavior in the context of warfare. For us to not become vicious brutes, we need to have a rigorous discipline of behavior in our day-to-day normal lives. The degree to which we cultivate holiness, to which we hold ourselves accountable to standards of morality in our normal civilian life, that will be tested to its outer limits when we have to then go to war. And therefore, what the Torah is doing is creating that framework of mitzvot, that framework that is pushing us to be so sensitive, so careful in our actions, in our thoughts, in our speech, that it will be natural to have that carry over when we find ourselves in an abnormal situation of warfare. Let me conclude by saying that at the end of our parsha, we speak about warfare as well. Chapter 25, verses 17 to 19. And it has to do with remembering what Amalek did to us. And I would like to just focus on who is Amalek? What is their war ethic? It says, remember what Amalek did to you on the way when you left Egypt. And it uses the word Asher Karcha Baderech, which for the moment I'll translate as, he cooled you off. And then it says, and he tailed you, all the stragglers from behind, and you were tired and weary, and he did not fear God. Who is Amalek, and how is that reflected when they engage in war? Let's start from the end. Amalek does not fear God. There is no awareness of God. Not only is there no awareness of a God who is in their military camp, there is no awareness of any God in their day-to-day life. But it's not just an awareness of God, it's fear of God. And the rabbis understand fear of God in the sense of being accountable to God, being subordinated to God. Their denial of God also makes them deny any sense of accountability to anyone, any entity, to taking responsibility for what they do. And I would perhaps even add to that, to at any given time really asking themselves, is this the right thing to do? I go back. Who does Amalek fight? The ones who are straggling behind. They fight you when you're tired and weak. The rabbis on the word nechshalim make a play on words with chalashim, the weak, the women, the children, the old. Amalek tries to find the weak spot of the Jewish people, attack them, attack those who are unable to fight back. In many ways, it's an unfair fight. It's not soldiers against soldiers. It's attacking innocents. And then we go back to the first thing which is mentioned. Asher Karcha, he cooled you off. That's one explanation which is brought in Rashi. But Rashi brings another explanation, and that explanation is echoed in a number of commentaries. The word karcha is related to the word mikre. the same word which appears in chapter 23 in our parasha regarding a nocturnal emission, something that happened. And what does that mean? Well, when Amalek went to fight you, oh, it just happened. What do you mean it happened? Why did they do it? What was really motivating them? There wasn't really a good reason for doing it. Random. They felt like it. And in a previous podcast, I've discussed that Amalek is basically an ideology of randomness, of chance. That all of life is just a question of random events. Ultimately, there is no purpose in life. There is no sense of standard morality, of aspiration to something higher. You act as it comes. Amalek, in the way they behave, in their attacking the Jewish people, and I should add, in their attack of the Jewish people, they reflect not just how they behave in a military context, but they reflect who they are in a civilian context. They are the inverse of the Jewish people. They don't fear God. They don't have standards of morality. They don't have any sense of accountability. They look to prey on the weak, on the sick, on the tired. They take advantage of randomness. Last month in Israel, we were engaged in a battle against a modern form of Amalek. And I feel very, very deeply that what happened here, this reflected a very real clash of value systems. It was a situation where initially three youths were murdered and where it was clear beyond any doubt, certainly at the end of the war, that this attack against three teenagers was orchestrated by Amalek. Why were they killed? Random. Did they do anything which was wrong? Nothing that was wrong. But it was the idea of attacking those who are weak, who are unprotected, who are not expecting that such a thing will happen. And then subsequently, when Israel began rounding up terrorists, all of a sudden rockets were launched. Where were the rockets launched against? Not at army installations. Randomly. Not only randomly, but consciously at civilian targets. How many times did we hear that they were trying to shoot rockets at Ben Gurion Airport, at civilian airlines, and all the bravado about building rockets that could reach Tel Aviv and Haifa, not the occupied territories? And then the other side of the coin, where were the rockets fired from? From the midst of civilian populations, from schools, from hospitals, from mosques, from shelters, UNRWA shelters. The leaders, where were they? They were underground. And they used their people in a very cynical way to be their protective shield. Not only did they attack us at our weak spot, targeting our children, our elderly, our civilians, but they also hit us in our weak spot, trying to force us to compromise everything that we hold dear in our value of human life. They egged us on to shoot and kill their civilians. They egged us on to become brutal and vicious. And in doing all this, there was no sense of accountability, no sense of taking responsibility for all the death and destruction. In fact, if I throw in another element that we discussed, there was unbelievable pride in whatever havoc and destruction they could create. If Israel prided itself on doing everything to minimize civilian casualties, not only of Israelis, but of Palestinians, Hamas did everything to take pride in whatever people they killed and whatever destruction they could create. And even in the end, when there was a ceasefire that was declared, how did the two groups react to the ceasefire? In Israel, there was a tremendous sense of trepidation, and I would even say of soul-searching, and concern that in the end, would the ceasefire lead to being able to go back to life as normal and to stopping all of the bloodshed and destruction? But in Gaza, the end, the ceasefire was marked by jubilation, by celebration. And how do you celebrate? By shooting weapons. Shooting weapons where, as a result of the celebration, two people were killed and more than 20 were wounded. Did anyone say something about why should people be wounded and hurt in a celebration? And was there really room to celebrate in the aftermath of such destruction and pain that was brought upon their people? It is important for us to realize that we do have standards that we hold ourselves accountable, and that we do have a vision of a Jewish army, and that we need to see our army as an extension of the society that we create, and to constantly be asking ourselves, what can we do to hold ourselves more accountable, and to ultimately do those things which will magnify our human dignity, which will promote building and life. We are approaching the end of this year. Soon it will be Rosh Hashanah, and in the classic rabbinic wish, may this year end with all its curses, and may the new year enter with all of its blessings. Shabbat Shalom.
Thank you, Rabbi Schweiger. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you on the next episode of Pardes from Jerusalem.